This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Coming up today, we'll dive into the Investigatory Powers Bill. We'll find out what the police are told about drones and how to arrest you, and we'll also find out why your email might soon reply to itself. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me are James Temperton.
Good day.
And Matt Burgess.
Good afternoon.
So today we're going to kick off with a new feature, Today I Learned. So, James, give me one thing you learned this week.
Well, I'm going to chicken out because I haven't been able to verify my other facts. So I'm going to go back to the one that I mentioned just before we came in. It's the origin of a word. Etymology is a particular favourite of mine. The word mellifluous means to flow sweetly like honey, which is why some languages use, I think, melee as the word for honey. So when you listen to mellifluous music, you are listening to the sweet honey-like flow of sound.
Wow, how is that for a cold start to a podcast? My fact I learned this week is that 90% of all viruses on the human skin are unknown to science. Mind blown. Read more at wired.co.uk. Matt, what did you learn this week?
Well, yours are both quite physiological and scientific. Yeah. Whereas mine, I learned that you can't go to the gym at 10 p.m. That's based on personal experience. I haven't been watching other people going to the
gym. It's not a scientific report, but it's factually important nonetheless.
There's probably some science behind that, right? Your body is getting ready for bed at 10 p.m, not getting ready to go and run around on a treadmill.
Yeah, it probably doesn't really want to be going to the gym and running on a treadmill at that time, but I did, and it didn't work, and today I can't really stand up.
You're a shambles. So, sorry. So, Matt, as the new resident and freedom of information expert, today, this week rather, you had some information about what the police are told about drones. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, so I asked for some documents from the Home Office about how the police arrest people for flying drones and what sort of the circumstances and basically their guidance around when they can and when they can't and what they can and can't do when it comes to people flying drones out in the public space.
So this is separate to the drone code and the law surrounding drones, which, as we know, have been established for a pretty long time. You can't fly them over populated areas and so on. This is how police are trained to deal with those situations.
Yeah, so it is pretty it's clearly set out what people can and can't do and shouldn't do with drones. But in terms of what the actual police's approach is, that's when it becomes slightly different. They're obviously looking out for people flying drones above crowds of people, too close to airports, around sort of issues that could be security problems. But basically, police can and can't do a number of certain things. And I take it you want to know what they are.
Yeah, well, they're not allowed to try and land the drone. They just have to pretty much ask you to, or then wait for the battery to run out, which I thought was quite a funny detail.
Because if it runs out, it will just fall from the sky.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so there are a number of laws around when they can and can't try and make arrests. So they can make arrests around things to do with national security, sexual offences as well. So if somebody's taken their drone up and is flying it above somebody's house and looking, recording them in their garden, they might be sunbathing in the back garden. So that's around sort of voyeurism and that type of thing. So there's a number of different reasons why they can't. But as you say, like when police suspect somebody is using a drone wrongly, using it in an inappropriate way, they have no power to take the controls off of you if you're flying the drone. They have to just say, very politely, I assume, ask you if you'll land the drone. And if you say no, then they're told just to wait till the battery dies.
They also don't have the power to demand footage or to demand its deletion.
Yeah, there is no power under the laws that says that they, in any laws that says that they can take the footage off of you.
But they can ask to see it.
Yeah, they can ask to see it and view it, but this is something that, well, the guidance actually contradicts itself. It does say that there is no power to take it, but they can have a look at it, but there is no lawful power to look at it. They can ask if you can view the footage, but there is no actual law.
So this is kind of important. If you are someone that flies a drone around to take footage of whatever it may be, and a police officer comes up to you and asks to see that footage, despite the fact that the police officer is asking, they don't actually have any right to see it whatsoever.
No, they don't. And there was a case last year of a photojournalist, and it's worth pointing out that most most drones that are being flown in this country commercially are through by journalists or through companies who are doing mapping and surveying and taking images. So a lot of the actual professional use of drones is around photography and video. But yeah, there is not a legal right there for people to actually be able to, for the police to be able to see this.
What I thought was amazing is that the police, by definition, are told that you are committing a crime if you are looking through first-person goggles when flying your drone, because technically you don't have your eye on your drone, even though you are seeing what your drone is seeing.
Right, it's all about direct line of sight.
Right, so but that direct line of sight doesn't count if you're seeing through its own eyes.
No, which would give you a better perspective of it. But I guess the argument would be that those goggles could break or the connection could go bad and all of a sudden you'd be flying blind, right? You could have flown this thing.
How long are they going to break before you just go, oh, I'm sure it was fine, and you're just flying in direct, you know, in total darkness? Seems a bit silly, but I get the idea. But it's fun that the police have to have this kind of thing spelled out to them.
How up to date, having read through the whole document, how up to date did it seem to you?
It was published this year, or it was issued to police this year.
But are they up to speed with technology, or did it feel a bit fuddy?
It didn't feel too bad. It could have been a lot worse, because there is stuff around there in first person goggles. There is stuff around different types of drones, and really just the police look like this is something that is going to evolve, and sort of their handling of people who are flying drones, because a lot more people are going to be getting them for Christmas. You can go down any high street and virtually buy a drone now. So I think it's people need to be aware of what the police can and can't do, and what they should and shouldn't be doing.
And I guess it's that kind of thing. Pretty much they're just refreshing officers' minds in the same way that the CAA is issuing that drone code this summer. We're refreshing customers' minds. It's not that actually there needs to be new legislation, because things like this have been around for a really long time. Remote control helicopters have been able to be camera equipped for ages. But it's reminding people, making sure that they're aware of what the law is so they can accurately deal with it, which is probably a good thing, but it does make it a very funny document to read.
Michael, elsewhere this week, we could be able to fly to New Zealand in 4 hours, which we've never heard before.
Yeah, the 4 hours claim for future aircraft to be able to fly from London to Sydney is one that pops up in the tabloids pretty much every month, as far as I can tell. I've been a journalist for about 10 years, and I've written that story at least 10 times.
But this time
might be different, or might not. This is the Skylon superplane, which is based on a new type of engine, which the UK government has poured £60 million worth of funding into this week.
And it's got a really dynamic name.
It does. It's called the Sabre engine.
Sabre.
Yeah. And actually, this isn't new news in as much as the engine's existence. We've been hearing about this in one form or another for at least 5 years. But the actual technology is very cool. So the idea of Sabre, it's a kind of a combination of a rocket and a jet engine. And the idea is if you can cool the air that pours through the engine very, very rapidly, you're able to make the engine much more efficient and thus more powerful. So the craft by Reaction Engines, which is the company which has received this funding, and also a new deal with BAE Systems, the engine's able to cool an incoming jet stream from 1,000 degrees centigrade, sorry, Celsius, to minus 150 degrees Celsius almost instantly at about 1,000th of a second. Now, that's pretty good. And what that means ultimately is really, really exciting things for air travel if it can get off the ground. So the idea is that you'd be able to send a commercial plane pretty much into space around the curve of the Earth and back down very, very fast, very efficiently and very cheaply, possibly as well, enabling commercial space travel, but also enabling the launch of satellites and other kinds of spacecraft into orbit, which would be fantastic.
But that sort of near-Earth orbit hop has been the way that this has been speculated as for quite a long time, right? We've always said you can get to New Zealand in 4 hours if only you can get something into space cheaply enough and safely enough.
Yeah, and part of that is, you know, you can avoid all the kinds of noise regulations. You can go as fast as you want. There's no problems with air traffic or any of the other things
or
that going
atmosphere.
All those things that make going at very high speed very, very difficult. So this is really exciting, and this has been backed previously in both statements and money, I think, by the government from about 2010. But this is the most significant funding yet: £60 million, 5 years away, they reckon, from a ground test. So that's just the engine physically attached to the ground. That even is 5 years away, and then 5 years beyond that, some kind of unmanned test of the craft itself.
And what about manned tests?
Well, there's no word on that yet. And obviously, any kind of new engine like this takes a lot of testing. And we are not in the era, sadly, of the early flight pioneers who pretty much would just attach an engine to something and then go up and see what happened. We're not really living in that world. And this obviously is one of those things that is both exploring the limits of putting together engines, but also the limits of some of the physics around this. I mean, obviously, cooling incoming air to that extreme degree is really, really difficult. And one of those things, obviously, they haven't quite got a handle on yet. But a £20 million investment by BAE and £60 million by the government is pretty significant indication that there's something in this.
But would it be a good thing for the world if the world were to become that much smaller? There's something quite refreshing. So half of my family lives in Canada. That's quite far away. It makes going to see them more of an event. Were I able to pop over there for the weekend, that would be very strange. And suddenly Canada wouldn't feel far away. India wouldn't feel far away. Places that feel very distant would suddenly be very easy to get to. It would be like going to Edinburgh on the train for the weekend.
I think there's a pretty good argument to say that the expansion of global travel has increased the general level of understanding in the world and made us a better place. So I kind of think it will still continue, but you know, you might be right. Also, I imagine this is still going to be pretty expensive. These are going to be very specialised craft.
That's my big cost. That's my problem. The actual cost of it. How much is it going to cost to fly at these sort of, well, to take the old trip across to New Zealand or somewhere? Is it going to be one of these cases where you're looking like Concorde, innovative, brand new type of travel, or
super fast, but could only be used by business executives?
But also, I mean, Concorde is a good point, and as much as that was an innovative flight system itself, and didn't, as you say, prove to be financially viable. But if we could bring that back in some form, it would still be possible to get to, well, New York at least, in about 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, it was pretty speedy.
Yeah, but, and you know, that was to do with noise regulations, and that was why it was commercially unviable. I guess the idea of this is that that becomes less of an issue because you'd be flying above the air. Yeah, that's true. But yeah, that happens, obviously, as we know. But it's at least good for Oxfordshire, if not the rest of the world, which is where Reaction Engines is based. And so it's a British success story in tech, and also one of those things that, again, looking forward 10 years, could be really exciting. And there are lots of new types of propulsion systems that are kind of in the ether, some of them real, like the Sabre, some of them perhaps not so real, like the M-Drive, which a lot of people came to our website to read about this week.
Yeah, or antimatter rockets, which is a whole different puzzle. So it's at the bleeding edge of physics, right, where there's the idea that certain things could be possible if only we could work them out.
That's right. And, you know, so Ryan Weed, who is one of the speakers from Wired 2015 and Wired Next Gen, whose video you can now see on our website because, plug, all of the videos from Wired 2015 are now available on our website.
Michael's had a fun week uploading things to YouTube.
Uploading, downloading, uploading, titling, tagging, re-uploading and re-tagging.
So watch them.
Yeah, please do. But no, there's an interesting talk. But obviously, as you say, Matt, we're kind of some way away from these being commercial products. This is a research investment by the government and obviously a long-term investment by BAE. It's going to pay off perhaps in a decade, or it might not, but I think it's probably a good thing that the UK is generating this kind of business and this kind of science. So good news all around, I think. James, another technology which is extremely old and in need of refreshing is email. And this week we learned some interesting things about the frontiers of that particular service.
Right. So I think we can all agree that email is just a little bit rubbish, right?
Yes.
We get inundated with emails, some of which are relevant, some of which are not. And the job of automatically filtering those emails and working out what should go where so that you don't have to is something that's been going on for a while.
And yet people still use email a ridiculous amount.
Yeah. When it's completely, it's a waste of time.
But it's still one of the most popular forms of communication on the internet. It just needs to get better, right?
Yeah, so a lot of emails that people get can normally be responded to with quite a curt but polite, in a way, yes, no, or ask someone else. Certainly I find that's the case, particularly with work emails. You can normally quite easily reply to them with a short answer.
I don't know about you, Matt, but I'm taking this pretty personally.
I've read your email, so
I mean, we sit next to each other, so we don't tend to email that much. So Google has worked out a way to get machines to do grunt work on emails that require a simple answer. They've called it Smart Reply, and it uses machine learning to scan emails, work out if the email needs a reply, and then look at the context of the email and work out what that reply should be, and then write it in natural human language.
And this is one of those things which is really exciting and not scary, that Google is reading and is able to reply to your emails for you.
Right. Well, I mean, everyone knows that the reason Gmail is free is because Google scans every single email you get to sell you, to show you very accurate advertising. So if you're planning a holiday to Croatia, it's no coincidence that your Gmail adverts are suddenly for creation, holidays or flights or money changing or whatever. So this is just another sprog of that, I suppose.
So how does it work, James?
Well, it uses a pair of recurrent neural networks, one that encodes the incoming emails and one that comes up with possible responses. And it does this by looking at the words one by one and assigning them a number, effectively. And the machine learning system then looks at the number, works out what those numbers mean, and then spits them out the other end. So if I were to send you an email saying, do you have any vacation plans for December? And your response would probably be, no plans yet, or I just sent them to you, or I'm working on them. And the machine would be able to work out that that would be the likely reply based on its understanding of the context and also past experience with how users had used the system. So Google's been testing this for some time, and in testing, it found that the machine's fallback was to go to popular responses. So an awful lot of people apparently replied to emails by saying, thank you, or I love you, or things like this. And in the business environment, if it didn't understand the context of the email and couldn't come up with a reply, it would just go, I love you.
Well, you know, to me, the explanation I'm sure makes sense. All I pretty much read from that is it's a big magic box with the words AI written on it, and then something goes in one end and something else comes out of the other. I'm sure it's very clever. But it takes away, to me, one of the great pleasures of email, which is not replying to it. It's my favourite thing about email, just letting stuff come in and then just drift away.
But the more that you do reply to emails, then the more the system will learn, and then the less you'll have to reply to emails.
I suppose that's true, yeah.
No, and then absolutely. We'll end up in some utopia where no one's ever replying to any emails, and everyone's just replying through machines.
And there's actually an interesting wrinkle to this story, which is that the developers of it weren't allowed to look at emails that they were working on to develop the system while they were working on it.
Yeah, the system is completely blind. For privacy reasons and in order to make it useful, you wouldn't want a machine learning system that had to be babied or have its hand held. So everything it does is blind. It gets the data and it works out itself what the email means. It doesn't have any help. And so it's doing that all artificially.
But is the hope eventually that we're going to get to more complex replies and it's going to understand more about your email to the point where it can become a genuinely intelligent assistant rather than just... Because some of these responses are pretty short, and I'm sure if I received them and realised they were auto-replies, I'd be pretty cheesed off.
I mean, I guess. They'd still tell you what you needed to know.
Yeah, but you know how Gmail already has like a set replies thing? And if you set it up and send one, you just feel terrible immediately, and everyone always knows when you've sent one of those things, particularly when the auto field of name, where it's supposed to insert someone's name, just says name or says the wrong name, which happens to journalists a lot, as most people who follow us on Twitter probably know.
Yes, dear contact,
yeah,
rather
exactly.
than dear Michael.
I get dear Mark a lot.
That's nice. Mm. So I think what will happen is it will get more intelligent with time. So just as the Google engineers taught it that I love you wasn't an appropriate response to an email asking about financial results, the system will learn that certain responses are better for certain contexts. It will maybe develop more complex responses. And they'll effectively, it's a bit like Google Translate, right? Google Translate works from a very simple base of knowledge and is then expanded by how useful users find it. So Google Translate is best at translating between languages that people translate between often, English to French, French to Spanish. But it's terrible at translating, well, not terrible, it's not very good at translating between English and Afrikaans or English and some obscure language from Southeast Asia, for example.
See, I also think we're missing a trick here because, you know, if GCHQ are going to be reading our emails anyway, they might as well respond to them while they're doing it. It's
right.
Just save Google the bother. But so how am I able to use this right now?
Well, if you download the Inbox app, which is Google's sort of experimental Gmail replacement, it does lots of clever things like automatically setting up calendar appointments for you, and it scans your emails for flight bookings. It does all sorts of clever things that Gmail doesn't do by itself. So it's Inbox for Gmail by Google, the app for Android and iOS. It's available right now. It's free. You can go and download it, and you can start using Smart Reply right away.
Other email clients are available.
Quite right. Yes, and other huge data-grabbing companies are also available.
And now, just time for the weather. James, what's the weather in the universe?
Well, the weather in the universe turns out to be very, very strange. This week, we looked at some of the weirdest weather that you get in the universe. This is all after a rogue exoplanet known as PSOJ318.5-22.
It's another snappy name by the international astronomy community there.
Yeah, it's great. But yeah. They found that this rogue, weird planet has molten iron rain, which sounds lovely.
I'd love to see it. I'm just not sure I'd like to stand underneath it.
Yeah, and it turns out that that's nowhere near as weird as weather gets, particularly on exoplanets that we're discovering more and more of these days. Another planet with really weird weather is HD189733b, which has a lovely blue hue, but temperatures on the surface reach nearly 1,000 degrees Celsius. Centigrade. Celsius. Which one's right, Michael?
Celsius.
Celsius. And it rains glass sideways. Winds reach speeds of up to 4,000 miles an hour.
That's quite harsh, that, isn't it? I mean, if it's already raining glass, and then it starts to rain glass sideways.
Mm. I mean, that's a gas. It's a gas giant, so you couldn't really stand on it. You could just get dropped into it and get ripped to shreds by high-velocity, exceedingly hot glass.
But some of this rogue weather is even closer to home. On Mars this week, we learned some astonishing stuff about the fog they get there.
Right, so acid fog, a combination of stuff coming out of the rocks and the water that was on Mars a very long time ago and that is still there in smaller quantities, evaporates up into the air, makes a fog, which is acidic and is dissolving rocks on the Martian surface, we now think. If you go to places like Io, which is a moon of Jupiter, you'll find that temperatures range from freezing, which is kind of pleasant on a winter's day, nice crisp winter's morning, to 1,700 degrees. And because of its low gravity, its volcanoes can shoot up to 250 miles above its surface. So it would look kind of impressive. So
what's this going to mean for when our space travel and when our shuttles and our ability to actually go further into the universe becomes a reality? What's it going to mean for
us? Take a brolly and a sensible winter jacket.
And a robot, I think, is the other thing.
Yeah.
And also, we need some luck, I think. You know, because on Mars, as you said, acid fog is a thing, but they also have enormous cyclones that reach up kilometres into the sky.
And just
huge
rip
winds,
across the surface
storms,
for days.
Yeah, absolutely, dust storms. And yet we still manage to send very, very complicated robots there, and they can survive for a couple of decades. But, you know, I think it's going to be tough. I honestly think that remote presence robots are going to be a huge thing for space exploration. I'm looking forward to, when I'm 80, exploring the surface of Mars as if I was there, but without any humans having to go. Yeah. Seems a lot more simple.
It'll be super nice. One last bit of space weather. I quite like this one. On Neptune, it has the fastest winds in the solar system. We've known this for years. 1,300 miles per hour, which means that you'd be able to hear them breaking the speed of sound. Except you wouldn't, because it's minus 218 degrees, so you'd freeze to death instantly.
Which would be a problem.
Upbeat, but you know, it does put the fog in London into perspective a little bit. Well, still to come, perhaps the most significant piece of legislation for the future of the internet in the UK in history was unveiled this week. We'll dive into the implications and why nobody outside of Twitter or the tech press seems to mind very much. This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree, code for easy online payments. If you're working on a mobile app or website and searching for a simple payment solution, Braintree V.0 allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more, all with a simple integration. Just one snippet of code and you're all set up, ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. For information and to try out the sandbox, go to BraintreePayments.com now. Braintree can't wait to see what you make of it. So Matt, we saw the IP bill finally unveiled this week in the Commons. What did we learn and what's still to come?
Well, the IP bill, it's 299 pages long to begin with. So,
and we pretty much forced you to read all of it. You started to lose your mind a bit before the end of the day on Wednesday.
Yeah, it was a long day on Wednesday, but it's an important day, I think, because this piece of legislation is the government's bid and it's the government's plans to change how security services, police forces can actually look at and monitor online communications. It's primarily aimed at catching terrorists and criminals, so we're told, but it basically legitimizes some of the powers that have been in force for the mass collection of mass surveillance of people. It's putting everything into law and sort of condensing and bringing everything into one place. So there have been multiple laws, multiple different regulators around this area, and they've all sort of been brought into this one piece of legislation to try and make it clearer for people to understand.
And people will have heard, obviously, of the Snoopers Charter. That was a previous attempt at legislation, but this is a very different bill.
It's different in some ways. The government and Theresa May, when she was standing up in the House of Commons, looked to say that it wasn't a Snoopers Charter. This is something that they have done that has changed completely, and there is very much differences between what was known as the Snoopers Charter and this new bill. Campaigning groups have said that there aren't as many differences as the government would like to make you think, and it's still causing problems. But I think the overall thing is it is a piece of legislation that is putting everything into one place.
So let's just give a brief overview of the main points of that legislation.
So one of the main points is oversight. So for police forces and security agencies, and there's a difference between some of them in the nitty-gritty details of the legislation, to look at a person's communications, they have to have a reason, but they have to get warrants signed off. So they have to get approval from higher up. In the past, this has been ministers. So this has been Theresa May herself, the Home Secretary. She spends several hours a day doing these. She's still going to be doing them, but there's going to be a panel of judges above her that can decide if the system has been done properly and if the surveillance is warranted, if it is justified. So that's one of the main things that's been criticised by people who have said that the judging panel would just be rubber stamping the decisions and politicians shouldn't have anything to do with it. The second area is interception and bulk powers. So the bill will consolidate interception powers that already exist. And basically legitimise the collection of data. But I think one of the big things here is web history and browsing information of people. So how many different websites do you go on in a day, Michael?
Honestly, probably about 300.
So that all of under these powers, communications companies, so your internet service provider is going to have to record and store these details of the websites that you go to on each day. So we're talking about the websites that you visit. So,
not the pages.
Yeah, so wired.co.uk rather than an article on wired.co.uk. But there is a problem with collecting all this information because it does build up a picture of you. So if I can see that James has been on wired.co.uk, he's been on the BBC, he's been on a local health website to his area, all these websites are eventually building up a picture of who you are and what you do and your life, really.
And there was a very good example of this doing the rounds on Twitter that shows exactly the kind of information you could get just from looking at the name of the website that someone was on. So you could start off with someone looking at an extramarital affairs website or a dating website. Then they look at a pornography website. Then they look at a relationship advice website. Finally, a suicide advice website. And then they're dead.
Yeah. Well, that's upbeat. Thanks, James.
Well, it is. I mean, this is quite serious legislation.
No, absolutely. But I think that's, again, it was presented as, don't worry, we're not collecting the data about the websites you visit. We're just collecting a list of the websites you visit.
It's to make it sound benign. It's like saying it's not a Snoopers Charter because we don't want to call it a Snoopers Charter because that sounds mean. We're going to call it the very dry draft investigatory powers
I'm
bill.
I'm sensing you mount your ranting donkey, but let's just run through the other main points of the legislation first.
The other main point before James gets onto his pony or donkey or whatever he rides around.
Could be both.
A hybrid of the two, is there's going to be hacking powers that are legitimised in law as well. So this is the ability for security agencies to install a keylogger on your laptop to be able to see every single thing that you type into your laptop. That's one of the sort of hacking powers that will be available, and they're going to be brought into law. So beforehand, they have been existed in some cases in really old law from the 1990s, and also in guidelines. So it's basically bringing these all into one place, and making everything sort of combined into one piece of legislation, which actually says what can and can't be done. So James.
Yeah, my donkey's chomping at the bit. Or whatever. I think the problem here is that the government's got away with quite a good bit of PR. So Edward Snowden leaked all the information. Everyone got a bit oversaturated with it. There was way too much information to sort of process. There were loads of stories about it. We were meant to be outraged. Not many people were really outraged. It went through this debate. The government proposed laws that sounded really shocking. And then they worked out a way of explaining those exact same laws and all of those things that we were outraged at and that Snowden said were huge abuses of power, and it's managed to legitimize them by putting them in a 299 page document and saying that they're adding oversight, which is crazy.
Do you have sympathy for the Home Office in as much as if your job is to keep people safe and to effectively break into and monitor terrorist organizations or organized crime, they, to their mind, didn't have the tools they needed to do that legally. And still don't, and that this legislation gives them those tools. Do you at least have sympathy for that mindset or that aim?
So they've gone about making the process legal, but the law's an arse in this instance. So it was a horrible thing for them to be doing without legal justification. So now they're just trying to shoo.
Well, they would argue that they were keeping people safe. And Theresa May indeed stood up in the Commons and gave some relatively specific examples that she said either we were able to stop people being harmed in those cases because we had this type of data, or we would have been able to do our jobs easier if we had had more access to data in this way.
And we've seen this grandstanding and positioning by the government for the last month. There's been a steady trickle of very well-placed stories in certain areas of the press and certain people coming out to speak. We had the head of MI5 doing an interview on the BBC Radio 4 Today programme for the first time ever. So there's been this softening. They're trying to soften the issue, bring it round to their point of view, whereas what the issue should be is what happened at the time of Snowden. That outrage, that level of, good God, how can they access that much data? How is this legal? Turns out it wasn't. Now it's going to be.
And they've more or less succeeded, right? Because what we haven't seen, although obviously there's been criticism of this in the press, on social media, as you would expect, there's criticism more or less of everything on social media, and within tech specialist websites and obviously on Wired, we haven't seen any kind of real public outrage over this yet, and it doesn't seem like we're going to. Indeed, most opinion polls seem to suggest that people are broadly in favour of this type of thing, or have that attitude of, I haven't done anything wrong, it's just about the terrorists and the criminals.
I've got nothing to hide. I was thinking about it, because that's the argument, right? I was thinking about this. Michael, do you feel that you have anything to hide?
Honestly, not really. I'm quite boring. But there are definitely things, you know, in everyone's life, I think, that you would rather keep private, or at least things you would like the ability to do without the worry that someone would be watching.
Matt?
But no.
There's nothing that I can think of that I would want to hide, but there are things that I wouldn't want the government to know about my life. I wouldn't want the government to be able to know where I'm going, what apps I'm using all the time, what I'm actually doing with every minute of my day, really.
Yeah, and that it would all be stored and logged against your name for 12 months in incredible detail. And it would be companies like TalkTalk that would be collecting it. And we've seen how good TalkTalk are at looking after people's information. All companies are hugely susceptible to attacks and to data breaches. And if they're going to start collecting and keeping all of this vast amounts of information about us mandated by the government, then where's it going to end up?
I mean, there are a separate issue as well, is the fact of whether this stuff is able to achieve what the stated aim is. If encryption is accessible in very intensive forms to virtually anybody for free instantly on the internet, then how is forcing Apple to give up its iMessages as might be necessary really going to change anything? The internet is a hydra. You cut off one bit, there's going to be three other interesting types of encryption that sprout up. Practically, it's not going to make it possible to access all these kind of communications. And ultimately, the kind of people it's going to penalise are people who don't have the will or the need to access that different type of encryption. So whether practically they're going to be able to access the information they want to is still in complete question, regardless of this new legislation.
And let's go back to the hacking thing briefly. So this is a really interesting point at which the government becomes quite hypocritical, and it struggles with itself. So the government's security apparatus has a responsibility to defend and protect the cybersecurity of the United Kingdom, in effect an army to keep us safe against threats from other nation states or malicious criminal organizations. But at the same time, it's allowed to hack its own citizens. And to, is it UK citizens or anyone in the world?
As far as I know, it's UK citizens, but they have to have there may be provisions for abroad, but there has to be a reason for them to do it. It isn't indiscriminate hacking,
yeah.
It's more of a targeted hacking.
But in order to use those hacking tools, they're using loopholes, security loopholes, and they're in some cases using zero-day vulnerabilities, and they're not reporting them. So you've got one arm of the government weakening security for its own gains, while another arm of the government is trying to close those security holes for the gain of the whole nation. So you end up with this really awkward position that shouldn't the bit of the government that's using zero-day vulnerabilities tell the other bit that they exist so that they could be closed? Well, of course they can't, because then they can't use the vulnerabilities to hack citizens of the United Kingdom. And it becomes this really weird, messy situation.
So do you expect, Matt, for the public to become more engaged with this? Because, I mean, I think broadly, we're all in agreement here that this is troubling stuff, and there are lots of big questions to answer, and that there are some fundamental assumptions that are broadly held about how this legislation will help, or the principles behind it, that I think at Wired we tend to come down on the side of not being on board with, frankly. And if you would like to read how to encrypt your data more effectively, we do have a special on that, which we've tweeted regularly, and you can find it on our site. But do you think it's likely that the public are going to get more engaged about this, more angry about this, or is this something that it seems like people are broadly accepting? I mean, we saw the Labour Party basically say they're going to support this as well.
I'd like the mass populace of the United Kingdom to get on board to support stronger encryption, stronger levels of privacy and their own data and take control of it themselves. But I really can't see that it's going to happen. I think that it's a case of for the common man in the street, to use a terrible phrase, they're not going to see they haven't done anything wrong. They're not going to see why they should encrypt their data, why they shouldn't. Boy, they should be worried about the government having information about them. So I think it's going to be one of these things that it would be better for people, for their own sake, in terms of their own personal privacy, to actually be able to keep this information about themselves private and care about this. But there are so many things that are going on. And at the end of the day, nobody wants to see a terrorist attack. Nobody wants to see the hundreds, thousands of people dying on in a mass attack. So if it's for some people, this view is that if it is a choice of that or losing a bit of your own personal privacy, where do you draw the line?
It definitely feels like there's a lack of international context in this world. In this as well, it has been pointed out there is no equivalent democracy in the world that demands this level of intrusion of its citizens. That if this were to happen elsewhere, we would probably decry it as a mass invasion of civil liberties. If it were to happen in one of the regimes around the world which we often find ourselves in conflict with, diplomatically or militarily, we would decry that as well. And yet somehow when it's happening within our own borders, it seems easier for people to take, because there's an assumption, I think, that, oh well, we're British, it'll be fine, they won't abuse it, it'll be wonderful. And yet where is this mass skepticism about politics that we're constantly hearing, this disenfranchisement, this hatred of politicians? How does that not translate into severe skepticism about how this law is applied in practice and what this makes possible in future? It really feels like a huge step that people aren't really willing to confront the practical realities of it. You know,
they've successfully made it very boring. I think that's
the name, the Investigatory Powers Bill.
It's a boring name. It's a seemingly boring topic. It's a very benign issue for most people, because even when this legislation is passed, which it almost certainly will be without many changes,
the Lords have said, and indeed you spoke to one Lord this over the weekend, Matt, who said that the Lords are going to attempt at least to fight back against this.
Yeah, there are some Lords and there are some politicians, even some Conservatives, David Davis, the Conservative MP, who can see the problems with this. They can see the loopholes, they can see the vulnerabilities that may actually cause problems for people, and they are, along with civil liberties groups, campaigners, they are pushing for changes. And there's going to be a long process of this legislation, because when the votes, and actually because it's only in a draft form at the moment, so there will be amendments, there's going to be a committee that scrutinizes it, and we're not going to see a final form of this until the middle of next year, really, and there's not going to be votes on it until then. So we're going to be covering a lot here. It's going to be a lot going on, and it's one of these areas that we need to really watch, I think.
Is there anything listeners or people who are concerned about this can actually do? Is it just a case of writing to MP and that being the democratic process? Or, you know, God forbid we start a change.org petition. But are there other things that people could actually do to affect the course of this? Or is it just too late?
I think for people that are concerned and do care, then writing to your MP is a good start. Finding out what their views are, finding out what all the issues are, what the actual problems could be if you're concerned about your privacy, and being informed on this, so the debate can spread wider. So even if it is just a thing where people speak to their friend, their mates in the pub and discuss something like this, which is, as we say, a dry piece of legislation, something that is complicated, but there is an impact on everybody in the country. So
you're not going to end up with many friends if you start talking about the Draft Investigatory Powers Bill over a pint.
No, it's admittedly a very niche subject, but it does matter.
Maybe people who drink pints like David Cameron would.
I don't know. I think bringing it up in the pub, if you use the right dramatic language and the right dramatic tone, I feel like you can get some conversation out of it.
Give it a go.
Well, I can't now. I've just drunk. I'm podcasted out. This is all my energy expended for the day. But, and you know, I don't have any friends. I don't go to pubs.
Oh, but we also asked the mass populace, right? We asked people on Twitter.
We did.
Which is sort of self-selecting because they follow Wired on Twitter. and wanted to answer this question, but what did we find out?
Well, unsurprisingly, 91% of people said they did not support the bill. We did accept non-binary answers as well via Twitter and via the email account, and you're welcome to send those in. We'll give a kind of a précis of those next week. It's obviously podcast@wired.co.uk or @wiredUK on Twitter, but no, the vast majority were not in support of the bill. But, you know, again, unsurprising. But, you know, still, hopefully there will be some collective action about this, not necessarily protests on the streets, but an increasing awareness of these issues. And I mean, I think the thing that's so difficult about this, sorry to go back into it, but it's the problem is that the Home Office is describing this as, and often does with this kind of legislation, as solving a problem that you can't see because the problem happens behind closed doors. But trust us, we need this stuff to make our jobs easier. But you can't see that for yourself. It implicitly is mysterious. And there's no real good way to make this argument unless you can practically show what difference it would make, other than just increasing the level of intrusion into our lives. And I was talking about this with someone over dinner yesterday, and the more I talked about it, the more annoyed I got. I got myself more annoyed than I even thought I was. And then you start bringing up 1984, but the parallels are really obvious. And really,
Theresa May even mentioned 1984.
Really?
Yeah, that's when the UK started bulk collection of data.
Yeah, that is when the sort of, this data collection has started. And to play devil's advocate, and I'm as angry as you are, Michael, about this, but to play devil's advocate, the Home Office is trying to tell people what it's doing. It is trying to admit that it has collected bulk data in the past. We know that from Snowden's documents, but it's actually admitted it. It's actually saying that this is what we have done, what we haven't done. It's trying to be more transparent.
But only because it got caught, right? So it's only being open, transparent, because someone went, oh, guys, you're doing this, and now everyone knows about it. So now you have to talk about it.
But also, it doesn't matter, because ultimately, in a society, we make a compromise. We say that we allow a certain amount of intrusion for the police to have certain powers in order to stop a certain level of crime. But we accept we won't be able to stop all crime or all terrorism or all violence, because we want to preserve certain civil liberties, and also we live in a real world. And so we could affix cameras in TV screens in every person's home, and we'd probably solve more crimes. But we agree not to do that, because we live in a free society. And this still feels like a legitimizing of that exact mechanism, or one of those things which is fundamentally changing that deal that we haven't signed up to, and that feels separate to what how we have lived before.
Now, if you're bored of three people broadly agreeing with each other about a piece of legislation,
send us an email and let us know.
Yeah, podcast@wired.co.uk. It would be really interesting to hear from people that do support this bill, because all the polling suggests that people do support it. They think it's a good idea, a necessary evil, whatever it may be. We'd like to hear from you. podcast@wired.co.uk. And if you don't have anything to do this weekend, you can find Michael on Twitter @MichaelRundle. Take him out for a beer and he'll talk to you all about it.
That's true. Also, needless to say, although obviously we'll be covering this in depth on Wired and we'll be mentioning it on the podcast, we do cover an incredible variety of stuff here at Wired: science, technology, gadgets, ideas, business, innovation, retail, culture, video games, all kinds of stuff. So we're going to keep doing everything we do at Wired, and we're going to do it with a positive and happy heart. I think obviously tech is still broadly a story of good things, but this is important, and I think we need to keep talking about it.
Next week, the podcast will be slightly more exciting, we promise. But we hope that you enjoyed and got something out of us talking through what can often be an ignored issue.
Sure. And as I said, @MichaelRundle on Twitter. Matt, you are?
@MattBurgess1.
And James?
That's the number one, not the word one.
The number one, yes.
The number one.
And James?
@JTemperton. No one had taken my Twitter handle when I signed up.
You are luckier than me.
I've got a more unusual surname.
And we'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.